The views and opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Rollins College.
All right, welcome back to Punkonomics. And we're having a discussion today about education, employment, and a few other things in between, besides joking around, too. Anyway, back on topic.
Yeah, so where were we, right? I mean, this, first of all, Shahid was proposing, was telling us about, and Jeff was commenting on the, this notion that some schools have apprenticeship that are really kind of meaningful. And that could be also in a very practical sense, where just like old school, at least, good MBA programs always required 2 years of work before they'd accept you even, right? So that you then indeed reflect upon your knowledge. You might be maybe on leave, but you're probably still working to some extent. So you're learning the theory of what you know on a practical level, or graduate programs in which your work is tied into an employment, and you're in the classroom, you're working on, you're getting training on material that then is also your work. And I think Jeff was also pointing out importantly that implies not necessarily to immediate practical terms where you're working in a company and learning a similar material directly related to it, but it can also be broader skills of reading, writing. I mean, we started that, right? I mean, searching the internet effectively, basic tech skills. We should all be able to knock together a couple of websites and RSS feeding into each other. I mean, the notion that it's like writing today. And probably a few others, skills like public speaking, you know, a lot of these things that are very generic and you can incorporate into a class about anything. And these are useful things that need to be practiced. In Germany, most famously, but other countries too, it's a kind of an old school approach where education, if it wasn't the classics, they were in fact kind of, applied too. I think Oxford and Cambridge back in the, Julian can correct me, I think in the 1860s and 70s, they wouldn't accept commerce or engineering as part of their curriculum because right. It was vulgar, right? Gentlemen need to know his Homer by heart, you know, and that's it, right? And then collect the rent on his land, yeah? Or theology, right? That was basically what they all offered. And I know that actually one of my favorite, maybe my favorite libertarian, he's left libertarian, he left The Economist back then because it was too conservative for him, Thomas Hodgkin, that started the Mechanist Clubs. So again, kind of private schools, in a sense, that dealt with commerce engineering that weren't in the big educational system independently to work on skills that people were interested. Until then, they were just learning by themselves, in a sense, but kind of formulating it a little bit. So maybe just like back in the Industrial Revolution, we're seeing world changes that are probably almost, if not maybe more, who knows, right? But it might be that we are living an era of dramatic change, just like the second half of the 19th century.
Well, it's interesting. And we need to change that, right? Stuff. The idea of what a classical education used to be in America, in the U.S., what do we do? Like, well, yeah, it's very rich people, they go to Harvard, but everybody else, they have to go to like a school where you actually learn how to do stuff.
And recently, didn't you? There was a study recently about from Ivy League, all these super high achievers, like Ivy League kids, that are really, really angry that they work all their, they sacrifice their youth, they finally get themselves to that apex of knowledge, and they are taught out of the textbook, and, you know, and they get a really lousy education in those institutions.
Yeah, there's an interesting book, I forget the title, but it's, I'll have to look it up, but it's about, you know, that sort of miseducation of that class,
right?
You know, and how and this particular professor, really well known, got a lot of flack for that.
Mm.
But
he's busy writing books and publishing papers. Again, I mean, to go back to, I mean, I understand we were, you know, rubrics, right? I mean, rubric is a compromise, I suppose, right? Because you don't have the time to carefully look at the student's work. You just don't have the time without sacrificing your career, essentially.
Yeah.
To give the students an amazing product, but then, you know, you got to put food on the table, too.
I think one thing that we keep dancing around, and you especially, Benny, is it's illiteracy. You know, ideally, we want students to leave with a set of literacies that are going to be the raw material that they can generalize to any domain, any context.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that literacy maybe in its simplest form is reading and writing, but maybe it's, as you were talking about and geeking out about, RSS feeds and more digital literacies and things like that.
Or reading media.
Exactly. Right. It's that etiquette in social spaces, pushing a particular brand, cause, or personality in the sort of social connected spaces as well. Mm-hmm. I think that's a huge part of the literacy. And then when you start to talk about learning styles and different types of intelligences, emotional intelligence and things, public speaking, that's what we want students to leave with, because they can be successful in many different contexts and domains that transcend making a coffee or doing a spreadsheet as a CPA or whatever. And I think that is so aligned to, us here, and I think that we have the foundation for that. Can we take that foundation and then operationalize that for the 21st century in the contemporary teaching and learning?
It's a revised liberal arts, basically. Yeah, exactly. I like, that's the way I see it too, so I think it's an important...
In this McDonald's...
It's not different. It's not a practical education as opposed to liberal arts. This is liberal arts expanded.
Standard, but can that be generalized effectively to create value for the modern liberal arts student? And I'd like to think so, because I think that the foundation is there. The focus on learning, the focus on teaching and learning is there. And we're in this context now of the McDonaldization of higher ed in many ways. I think there's an opportunity for us there.
But again, it boils down to who's employing, because you can be a jack of all trades, but if the employer is not going to give you a decent living wage, or it's not going to employ you.
That's why I say it's not, that's what I meant when I meant it's the wrong question. In a sense, it's not like up to us. This isn't a supply side, That's not going to help. I mean, we could prepare students to, let me rattle out the Bloom's taxonomy, that every class, like every video game that's worth that kids are willing to play, you should do, right? Remembering, number one, then understanding, applying, analyzing, evaluating, and creating. You should be going up and down that during the semester every day. Every assignment, you should get there. But will that get you a job?
Well, isn't that why we...
I could hire you as a professor, maybe, if we have an opening, but I can't get you a job.
It's really the job environment out there, because as a returning adult, I come from 20 years of airline experience talking about security, customer service, a whole bunch of other things. I come to Rollins, I get educated, I get a dual bachelor's in psychology, international affairs, and at this point, I'm like either overqualified, which I've heard, it kind of makes me feel good in a way. I mean, not so good, because I don't get the job. And then at the same time, it's kind of like, okay, we can't pay you what you deserve.
That's labor equivalent of it's not you, it's me getting pitched, right?
Right, right. So I know that it's not just... I know it's not just me. I've spoken to a lot of my former co-students who are running into that same situation. They're actually going to places like the Republic of Georgia to be able to get a work.
Right.
I agree with you, Benny. It's not really on this side. It's really on the employers, government, society side.
Yeah, the jobs have to be there. Certainly.
I think this is why we see the turn towards entrepreneurship, right? That this is a new narrative in contemporary education, emphasis on entrepreneurs, because you're not going to be employed, like you're not going to be hired, and so therefore you have to start your own business,
which is job creation,
which is. Yeah, you're employing yourself.
Well, still, you created a job. Even if you filled that seat yourself, you're creating the job.
Yeah, it's true.
But then that sort of begs the question, like with Starbucks, right? They're paying for their employees to go to school, get four-year degrees, which is obviously, I don't believe, a skill set that you need to be really, really good at being a barista, right? That's a very unique skill set, one that I wish that I possessed, and I do not.
I'm getting thirsty for some Starbucks.
Yeah, exactly, me too.
I make a killer espresso at home, by the way.
But what they're doing is they're going to educate their own employees in order to move out of that organization, right? And then you'll have new employees who are gaining the skills. They'll learn how to make the coffees and things like that, who then maybe are attracted to the position because they don't have an education, or because they want to pursue an education and they understand that Starbucks offers that as a benefit. So then you have the ones who have left who then will potentially return as customers, right? They have jobs now, and then they're going to be paying back into the market and things. Well, without being employed, where are they going to go and how are they going to spend that money? Exactly.
Right.
So then where's the benefit? Where's the benefit in a corporation like Starbucks or Walmart or these big corporations that we're talking about to provide education for their employees?
Well, I mean,
it's not
an individual,
right?
Hence the problem that we can't, that's why it's not a solution.
Sure,
I mean,
right.
It's a nice thing, sure, but it's not a solution. I mean, you can't see if the entire, you know, if you have major labor unions in the country that are on board, a little bit like Germany, though, it's not working as well as it used to back in the Werkschaftswunder days of the 60s. But, you know, that they come, they negotiate fair wages, they coordinate, the schools are on board, the industry is on board, the unions are on board, and they kind of coordinate together under some kind of system of consensus. But that's, again, like Levi, right, who had to go to class, said, how do we get there? And for that, we need serious political economic change. And perhaps, again, this is where you need to know your history, your economics, your sociology, not the indoctrination kind, but the real kind.
So let's welcome my Jay Gordon
to the
panel.
And, you know, the solutions that have been attempted successfully, unsuccessfully in the past.
But where does that political change start? It starts with the citizens, who hopefully will turn out to vote.
There's only 40% of the population of the United States were the ones that voted. In 72 years, we've never seen such a low turnout.
Well, Americans are smart. That allows me to do that shtick of mine, you know? Americans aren't stupid. They know that voting is useless. I mean, I know I'm being, like, really annoying here.
I disagree.
I understand.
I completely disagree. I think it's the uneducated who think that it doesn't apply to them.
Well, actually, most radicals don't vote because we know it doesn't matter. Who are we going to vote for?
There's got to be a middle ground between voting doesn't matter and people are stupid.
No, I don't think people are
stupid. But I mean, the fact that you have no one to vote for, I mean, at least until we organize, make constitutional change one way or another, I'm not an expert. Check out, you know, Lawrence Lessig about what kind of ways. Term limit is one thing, but not enough. But before you have a political system in which you do not have basically a one party that represents the same people and enact the same policies with a different flavor.
But you could argue then that an influx of more educated citizens would then create better candidates, which would then create better lobbyists and things like that, which would then create change.
Right. And, and then you also have
Too optimistic? You also have
the dynamics, the culture dynamics. Like, for instance, the Republicans are really good for going to vote and saying the same message. So, therefore, if you want to equate it in mathematics, these are the people that always are going to vote. If you don't go and vote, they're going to win anyway. So there's no change.
So what? Maybe it's better because let them be at the helm when the
on the radical side, to be able to do the changes that you guys are talking about, we would have to go back to the French days and do the guillotine on some of these people.
Well, you don't have to necessarily cut heads. Here I am being nice again. Well, probably, but let's maybe not. But revolution, yeah, you know,
okay, so
dramatically changing.
Okay, so we have a new version of politics that voting doesn't matter, and now we're chopping people's heads off.
If you want radical change, that's what you would have to do.
Look at the wonder that brought the world. You guys would still be speaking English if they didn't, cut those heads, in France. It was progress. It didn't work out very well at the end.
Of course, because we are paying taxes.
But we would be under the crowned heads of Europe still today without it, or something else. I mean, I'm not necessarily advocating a guillotine, though it is by far the most humane method of execution. And in America, we kill hundreds of people in ways that burned alive by the Spanish Inquisition is significantly less painful. Just wanted to put that out there. That's just a fact. You know, burned alive takes 5 minutes. At most, at the very most.
And you're warm for the rest of your life.
Yeah, but while in America we kill them slowly, 20 minutes, recently up to 40 minutes, and a lot of. So yeah, but seriously, dramatic change, systemic change. So revolution in the sense, hopefully, of maybe the British, the English, it wasn't Britain yet, a glorious revolution, right? Peaceful. But still dispossessing of the power of very powerful, influential people who lost their power, other people getting it, more diffused power, shift in power. There's no avoiding that to solve our environmental problems, our economic problem, our job problems. Because otherwise, again, we're replaced either by slave labor or by machines. And the machine thing is coming up really fast. You remember how 2 years and a half ago Corey was all over that, and we all looked at him like some kind of, you're reading too much sci-fi, but it's becoming scarier every day. So between the two, where's that aggregate demand? Where's the well-paying job or reasonably paying job, the opportunity to better yourself through getting higher skills, therefore commanding higher wages? Who you vote for doesn't matter. We need to reform the voting process. I'm being facetious. You know, it's punkonomics, right? You know, we're not reasonable here, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, we, as the system is today, the election is really a kind of a silly ritual. Like reading in the guts of the dog before going into battle.
Yeah, how is it a silly ritual? I mean, there's a question here about what Americans want in terms of voting. Mm. People don't turn out to vote in part because the two major parties are not really that far apart in a lot of ways. I think you have to be careful when you say that. But most Americans don't believe that their vote will lead to real change. That's their mistake.
But they don't act up and do the change themselves, and that's the problem.
Look, landslide successes 2008, despite millions of people being disenfranchised and massive voter fraud by the GOP. Everybody was so enthusiastic.
And in fact, you got real change from that. Like, you can be dismissive, but the fact of the matter is that the Democratic Party asked for health care for a long time and never got it. You can lie.
Yeah, but what we got is 90%
the
ritual.
The Democratic Party has not necessarily done all that it wanted to do, but there was real policy successes from that.
I'm going to argue that.
You can argue about it, but the truth will never, ever be different. It will be that fact no matter what.
Marginal.
No. Actually, you know, we can take something like healthcare, and what was it? It was a bailout for the huge insurance companies. I mean, Business Week, which is not a Marxist outlet, wrote an article when the law was passed how the health insurance companies have already won. And, you know, I am someone with a pre-existing condition, and I am on the ACA. And actually, one of the things that happened when I was signing up, you know, they call it the Affordable Care Act. The insurance companies can not provide you with essential medicines that you need, which is what they did to me, unless I pay for a higher plan with higher premiums and higher out-of-pocket costs. So for someone who has a pre-existing condition and is coming out of, say, running to Blue Cross with a $10,000 deductible, is now on, say, Aetna, and it's a little bit affordable, but guess what? They're not covering my medicines.
And you're not getting your supplement from the government? You're not getting...
No, I'm getting for the shared costs, but they're not covering my medicines. They're like, look, you know, you got to pay full price because it's not in-network, it's not out-of-network. They've also limited the size of the network. So whereas I would need a large sort of network because my illness is somewhat rare and I would need a doctor who knows about that, I have a limited network. So in terms of something like healthcare, there wasn't necessarily much of a change. I mean, it's good for some people. So if people are healthy and whatnot, they have affordable health insurance.
If you were uninsured, now you're insured. It was better to be uninsured and go to the emergency room than be insured.
But I still kind of have to do that though.
Because
I'm in a place where, you know, I have to get these medicines, but I don't have them. So it's what I'm saying is that there's not really much of a difference. We haven't wrested power away from the private insurance companies, who are the actual problem.
You know, exactly. And you know, you go back to the corporate America, right? They're the one that in control everything. And then you go back to the parties and who's in control. They're basically the same thing.
Yeah, it's the same people, same
and
family.
And then you go back, you know, to a poll. Last week you guys interviewed a politician in here. And I was listening to that, okay? And
we interview Wiley, the libertarian. We wouldn't allow anyone from the main parties to walk in the room.
And I was listening to that while eating a burger, and I met a friend who just came out of voting. You know, he just voted. He came in, and I asked him, you know, why won't you vote for? Did you vote who did you vote for? And why didn't you vote for the guy that you guys interviewed last week? And he told me, you know, he's a great guy, all of that stuff. He wants to limit the power of the government, corporations, all that stuff. But I did not vote for him because I know he doesn't have a chance to win.
Right.
Instead, I voted for that.
Right.
That's the Nader effect.
That's the dynamic.
That's the Ralph Nader effect.
Yeah, so here's the American public.
Well, the Ralph Nader effect isn't too bad. So we can take a point in history where you have someone like Nixon. Now, Nixon is the last liberal
president.
He's not a liberal at all. But, you know, he almost
lost. Compared to
anybody after him.
Seriously.
No.
No, but.
Tell me why I'm wrong.
No, but.
In comparison to Hitler, maybe?
A crook. No, seriously.
No.
A crook, sure. But no, by Democratic, too. After him? Who? Clinton? Obama?
Bush, probably.
They're all to the right of Richard Nixon.
Right. I mean, he almost lost, you know, the presidency to the third-party vote, so he had to somewhat appease those people. And
even George Wallace? That third party vote? Is that the vote you're talking about?
No, it's an interesting point to raise, precisely. I mean, maybe there is a possibility of, how about, I mean, right, if everybody did vote, made a point of voting, but voted only for third-party candidate. Hence this kind of notion that I say that I really do disagree, and we gave him a hard time, especially Jesse, the libertarian candidate, and he did very well, and we applaud him for it. But at least to kind of break that guaranteed ticket, you know, because we do know the Democrats that, of course they're good, decent Democrats, the marginal ones that sit on no committee, you know, of course they are. Just like they're even good, decent Republicans, not, you know, in both cases, a very small group.
I want you to define good and decent.
Not doing what, not passing along legislation from their lobbyists, Alec and company, you know, voting their conscience. So if the public votes their conscience,
like
potentially,
Paul?
it's hard for me to kind of bring it out of my mouth, but I got to give him some kind of, to the point. No, when he started off, yeah, remember his filibuster against the first invasion of Syria, yeah?
Yeah.
That was a high point in his career, but then he became a viable candidate. And which, of course, means corrupt, just like Elizabeth Warren. Not even an official candidate in any sense, but obviously kind of symbolic, very decent lady, great ideas with no impact because the Democrats cut every idea when, you know, the consumer advocacy completely emasculated everything, make sure it doesn't happen. And when she becomes even a candidate, she does her Israel-Gaza speech.
Same thing with Obama, you know, before his elections and what he was talking about.
Oh, Obama.
Palestinians and all this stuff. And then afterwards, you know, just.
Obama is brilliant in a sense that even today he often speaks wonderfully.
Yeah.
It just doesn't do anything that he ever says. He does the opposite in many cases. And you could even go to the crazy, I mean, you know, like Chomsky says, you know, yeah, you should vote your conscience, and I agree with him on that, except maybe presidential elections when you have a key state like Florida, Iowa, right? Stuff like that. Oh, then maybe you have to vote the lesser evil nonetheless. I don't know. I mean, the kind of Chomsky said something along those lines, and it's pragmatic.
I'm with Glenn Ford on this one.
Yeah, I hear you, and we could explore that, but definitely. So am I. I'm like the host, so I have to be reasonable here. Like I said, if you were home, I'd be already screaming some obscenities by now, you know? Channeling like Malcolm X speeches and stuff, right? But seriously, think even of the one thing that we all agree, okay, that's a wedge issue, right? Women's reproductive rights. So you gotta, yes, are you gonna hold your nose when you vote Hillary in 2016? But we have to, because of women's reproductive rights. I put to you that under democratic regime. They speak. They say that, you know, they don't speak like the Republicans do, and it amazes me how any woman still votes for them. but still, and a lot do, funnily enough. But and more. But they're closing clinics under democratic rule. So in a sense, they speak the talk. They get the votes.
But that's on a state level, though.
In the best case, they are ineffective. And in the worst case, like Jay was talking about Glenn Ford, they are the more effective evil. because they seem nice, they seem presentable, they're not these crazy racist loony bins of the Tea Party, but effectively they enact the same policy, with a smile and a shrug.
Yeah, sometimes worse.
I feel that it's incumbent upon me to at least talk about the nature of...
The voice of reason. We need somebody like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no. I don't get reasonable help. There is a question here about the struggle to rule, to govern, in our somewhat fractured political landscape, right? So President Obama is a perfect example of this. Yes, I recognize that now, when we look at him as a figure of change, he still remains a figure of change in my mind, because historically there are just certain things that you will never ever be able to, like, yes, I understand that. Okay. He didn't tear down all the horrible things that he wanted to
symbol
and
keyword there.
And I'm with you on that. Symbol. And often when this discussion bros up, I always make it a point to say, for Obama to do the things that we want him to do and that he wants to do, he would have to be a Hugo Chavez.
I mean, it'd be
that.
Almost impossible. I mean, you talk about these issues as if...
Viva la revolución.
That's right.
There is a magic bullet that will compel Democrats, especially conservative Democrats, to vote with him, who are, as you say, concerned about winning the next election. Mm-hmm. Even this last congressional election...
Yeah, he needs the money.
The logic here, I mean, what it costs to run for office. My own secret desire is that all the people of color would just sort of like realize one day, wake up and go, oh, I should join the Republican Party. Because this would actually change things. You show up, you sign on, like, right. I want to be a Republican. And then you go and you vote in the Republican Party. When there's a meeting, you show up. A bunch of black people show up at a Republican Party meeting, and you go, what are you doing here? Like, oh, we're part of the party.
Armed, preferably. I'm getting the 60s flashback, you know.
This would actually change the Republican Party. This would actually be, like, a good thing, right? Like, people would be participating. We always say, like, people don't participate.
Yeah.
And then the party apparatus would, one would hope, start to reflect their concerns as people from different backgrounds, the socioeconomic.
Yeah, it looks like they're scrambling for Latinos now, right? The Republicans, exactly. Because they realize they machine gun themselves in the leg by being so racist. Yeah.
And why are they doing that? Because their own strategist said to them, quite frankly, look, you can't pursue the same policies that you are doing right now because your core voter is old and going to die. And so they made a decision.
Hopefully they'll take the politicians that they voted for in the past with them.
No, because corporate America, it's not even America anymore. These are multinational corporations. They don't even have vague interest of American people in their minds. They're more interested in the rich in other countries than they are in the majority of Americans.
But it goes back to a question.
They reproduce themselves. They reproduce their power. So
but it does go back to a question anywhere. Of money. And a question of what do you need to do to attract a lobbyist? What do you need to do to attract the $2 million, or the $2.5 million that are required to run for any congressional seat in the United States? What do you need to do to counteract the third-party election campaigning that is going to go totally negative on you on every possible wedge issue that you might speak about? It's education actually has a role here because I can hear a negative ad and go, that's ridiculous.
So you don't fall for the standard.
And that ties it right back to the people who are educated are good consumers of data. They're strong, critical thinkers, and they're not just taking these messages. They're literate, and they have an agility.
They're also highly indoctrinated. I mean, you know, I'm not like saying, no, that's wrong, you know. Yeah, of course, and I believe in education, but it depends how. There's, especially in economics, you know, there's a tremendous amount of indoctrination going on so that people, well-meaning, and here we are at Rollins College, you know, overall demographics, you know, the 1%, yes? And many of them are well-meaning. You know, we really want to make the world a better place. And even a revolution, you know, even a popular revolution from the barrios needs allies in the upper classes. So I'm totally with it. But they are often highly indoctrinated in their view of the world, so that their education actually makes them believe that, oh, this is the best of all possible worlds.
I'm gonna go with you on the against the education thing as well. Because... you know, I tend to, with the people who I talk to who are educated about things like politics, they have a very, very poor political imagination. So poor that they don't even see, for example, minor revolutions among them. So you talk about the workers' cooperatives in Ohio or something like Valve, which is an anarcho-syndicalist sort of company or corporation. Not only do they not see that, but you know, this entire discussion about voting has gone back to the two-party system, and we're working within the two-party framework. Mm-hmm. And we're not talking about, well, how do we mobilize people to elect people from their own ranks and, you know, create a sort of shell within the old society, like a new shell within the old, and, you know, do what we want or do what we need. In fact, the poorest of the poor people are doing it. You know, you mentioned someone like Hugo Chavez, but Hugo Chavez was swayed by a number of political groups from the left and from
the right.
It
was the source of the revolution. It was
right.
Symptom of it.
Mm-hmm. Right, whose interests he had to, you know, adhere to and juggle. And, you know, if poor people, like poor people in Haiti and poor people in Bolivia and poor people in Venezuela can actually build, you know, a new shell or a new society within the shell of the old. So
in many ways, they are the most innovative in terms of these kind of political economic models. It's not an easy job to do, but that's where it's coming from. It's not coming from Harvard. But that doesn't negate what Andrea was saying, in a sense. I'm saying this is what we need to teach. And I do it here, you know, and I know some people might be, you know, unhappy with that, but actually the kids, 1% is most of them. Right? So they are, in some sense, against their interest. You know, they're good kids. They will listen to this and they say, I want to know about it, something different. I want to know about a different perspective. I'm tired of hearing from the same old, same old. So maybe this is a role for education, in some sense, subversive. Literally. Poisoning the minds of the youth in a productive way. You know, poison like good poison. Like nice wine.
Right, like good poison, of course.
But a grassroots activism is not outside the norm of a traditional education narrative, right?
Except when only rich can afford to go to school.
But that's where corporations who are paying for education now are working to make that gap a little bit more narrow. Because
of 1% is it? You know what I mean?
It's not enough. I mean, because people are attracted to work for companies and corporations because of their, of course, salaries, but then the benefits package, right? And dial it back however many years ago, and how many companies offered health insurance, right? And paid time off, right? I mean, Labor Day, that was established because people didn't even have really clearly defined hours for what they were working. So, I mean, we've made such huge growth, I guess, for employees of organizations that there's nothing to say that in 20 years it won't be the expectation that an employer will pay for education.
Interesting.
So then when you
We'd have to reverse the 30 years in some sense and reinvent the 60s and 70s.
Just a little secret about employers paying for education. So My employer, who I will not mention, does
Starbucks?
not Starbucks, but they do.
Worse.
But they do. So they do pay for your college education. But the thing is that they put people on really inconvenient schedule rotations. So if you talk to the people who work there, they're in school one semester, they're dropping out in the middle of the semester because the schedule rotation never gives them consistent hours. Mm-hmm. So they'll set up their hours, they'll set up their classes, and they'll have to drop out. And you talk to them, mm-hmm. and they're like, well, I have to drop out of school, and I've been going to, you know, Seminole State for 5 years, and I've been going to Valencia for 6 or 7 years. So, yeah, it's not enough that these corporations are, say, paying for education, because you could easily have a lot of these corporations could easily hire enough people and probably have like a 4-hour workday rotation and pay people a living wage so that they can afford things like college and so that they can use their leisure time to go to college. But they don't do that. So they'll pay for it.
Well, there isn't the environment for it, right? I mean, to go back to your, right. I mean, your complaint and your suggestion, Andres, like, in a time when they would compete for labor, they want the best quality, best educated, even a place like Starbucks, they want intellectual baristas. Imagine how cool that would be. You get your coffee and they, you know, spit something you didn't know at you, you know, something interesting and engage you in enlightening, you know, a comment. I mean, jokes aside, seriously, imagine the happy world, right? That could be. Yeah, a good barman is, you know, a shrink, really, right? Things like that.
Now they actually have a degree.
But they don't, yeah, right.
They're actually licensed. They can bill you in two different ways.
Right here, right? You know,
this is for the drinks and this is for the therapy.
Exactly.
Here's your coffee. Here's
it's
your
all like long-term economic trends, right? I mean, there was, is it going to be a competitive labor market in the sense of needing high-skilled labor and competing over it? There was a time when that was the case, and then private industry could indeed be, you know, it's in their interest. But if we allow them to run roughshod over the economy and to go back to kind of 19th century plantation capitalism, then they won't. I mean, because for the 1% or the 0.01%, it's better profit to be an imperial slave owner, you know, go to Roman economy, than it is to have an enlightenment, even 19th century capitalism, where you kind of need those skills, you need to reinvest in your company. We're not reinvesting, we're speculating, moving it abroad. So once again, I'm just saying that there's no escaping the literally revolutionary, though it doesn't necessarily involve cutting heads.
Although you are an outspoken advocate for that.
Well, I'm not an outspoken advocate. Well, I guess I come pretty close.
You can roll
to
back the tapes. You said it 3 times today.
I do. I'm just, as a historian, I have to point, as an economic historian, not a real historian. Julian's the real historian, so correct me.
Let's be clear, Vinny is
political change comes from the battle of a
second
gun.
Life. The guillotines and second life. Not
Vinny is talking about the elimination of the leadership in a classic sense. Like the heads he wants to cut off are.
It could be metaphorical.
So
redistribute.
I hope it's metaphorical.
Well, no, but I look at history and I look at the.
We're talking about a disruptive change.
What does revolution look like in education?
Exactly.
Yeah. What does that mean? A lot of people have talked about the bubble, the higher ed bubble, right? You know, is there a higher ed bubble? What is the value of your piece of paper, your degree?
Yeah.
So
certainly not what you pay for it. But you know what? I mean, this is going to get really ugly, and I, you know, nobody has to join in if you don't want to. I mean, I'm tenured. But let me say it. Other than the state no longer doing its major role of paying for higher education, thus promoting the high skills and innovation productivity of the economy, that Julian was at the very beginning talking about as being one of the reasons why tuition has gone up, the other is administrative bloat. And it's massive. So, you know, your faculty, permanent faculty goes up by a few percentage points over the last 20 years in most schools. Adjunct faculty by way more, and temporary workers by way more. Admin, 400-500%. You know, that's where there was a wonderful paper back in the day. God, I can't think. I could link it. You know, administrators ate my tuition. That was the title. Great title. So there's another aspect to it. So you have a kind of a big bloated bureaucracy, and like, here's my libertarian friends will surely appreciate the problem with that, right? It's private, perhaps, but it's still bloated potentially. Now, not that you don't need administrators. I'm not a, that's one of the problems I have with libertarians, but maybe not as much. Or maybe better incentivized to provide the necessary support for the actual core mission of education, etc. Though I am somewhat on the kind of, you know, left anarchist side when it comes to a big bureaucracy providing anything particularly useful by nature of that organizational beast. But so there is, I mean, so what? Why did I say it might be dangerous? I mean, to cut the heads, not physically. But do we need to spend more resources on the core missions of the institutions and the basic supports necessary and less on frills and other things that seem to be, we're kind of adding more and more elements into the institution? A lot of us, there's a lot of literature about it. Do we need all of these projects and offices and institutions and stuff, or should we focus more about the core experience of the students in the classroom?
But a lot of it also has to do with the amount of money that our elected officials are spending out there. I mean, yesterday on the news, they were talking about how Orange County is spending $200,000 to rent Impodium so they can have a meeting of some sort. I mean, $200,000?
You need a podium. I mean, the podium is the clipboard of, you know, 20 years ago. I mean, that's know you're said. In charge without a proper podium.
That's just said. When you look at society, the way it's being built, our own government officials and the voters are you know, should be penalized for it, for voting in these crooks. All the money that's going to these silly things could be going to education.
I think a lot of it, though, comes into training and getting people, you know, we talk about tools. There's all these great tools and apps and different programs and things, but they don't really talk about the goals and what they're trying to accomplish, and then they don't go back and reevaluate where the implementation of any of the money mm-hmm. or the tools or any of the other resources like time and training were really effective at all. You know, my son is in school, and he's in middle school, and he talks a lot. He's in some virtual classes. You know, he does virtual learning. Mm-hmm. And his instructor has a website set up so that students can access that from a distance, can work on assignments and things at their own pace. And it's a great, great system. Well, the website that the faculty member builds her personal website on is restricted. So when he's at his school and he goes to the media center during the appropriate time, he's not able to access her website because it's being stripped out by the web filters.
Mm-hmm.
And so then he ends up incredibly frustrated, and he has to do it from home, and he has to, you know, pick another way to do it. And so you have these instructors who are working on these tools, and you have students who are really eager to access them and use them, and they're ready. You know, they have the guillotines ready. They're ready for the revolution and to take their education in their own hands, and they can do it on their phones and their iPads and all these cool things. But then you have something like a website restriction that's implemented by the school, you know, because the school doesn't trust them to use the internet in an appropriate way.
Also, too, you know, just going back to the educational thing and the employment issue, one of the things that we can do, we have a serious environmental crisis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I discussed this on the last show. One of the things that we could do is that we could have... for example, with the bailout of GM, right? Mm. Everyone knows what happened. We bailed out GM. They paid Citibank $6 billion. They cut people's pensions and healthcare. We could have bailed them out and reconstituted, you know, as people have, like Noam Chomsky and Paul Street have argued, we could have reconstituted GM to build energy efficient technology, energy efficient cars.
In Detroit,
In Detroit, right? Mm-hmm. So Motor City could have been rebranded into a green city. The government is the largest buyer of cars in the country. They could have created the market for energy efficient cars.
But they won't. I mean, it's the same. I mean,
And we could also do the same with, say, you know, things like technology, like high speed rail. So instead of giving Egypt $10 billion in aid, three of which they have to spend on weapons manufacturers so that we can, you know, launder people's tax dollars so we don't know which companies are making which weapons, we could give them that aid and actually ask them to buy or procure energy-efficient technology and actually send people to school you know, for free or freely to go ahead and get the training that they need in, say, something like engineering or, you know, science or what have you, to find and not only energy efficient technology, but
They've known that for the longest time. It's just a one-sided profitability.
If you show me your budget, whether it's an individual or a corporation or the government, if you show me your budget, I can show you where your priorities are. You know, and we talk about energy-efficient vehicles and technology and mass transit, and you talked about women's reproductive rights earlier. And we talk about voting, and that happens so few times a year, but you have the opportunity to vote every single day with your dollar. You know, you can funnel your money into organizations like Planned Parenthood. You can buy cars, like hybrid cars and things like that. And the problem is a lot of people aren't willing to do those things because they don't want to spend the money or they can't afford it or, you know, it's not within their interest.
Right. So the majority of the people, they, even though they know in some sense, I mean, and I always like to applaud the American people are subjected. I say it again and again, but I think it always bears repeating. I think the American people are subject to the most effective brainwashing propaganda machine the world has ever known by several degrees. Nobody's seen anything like it ever. Yet, overwhelmingly, they know what's going on. They know what they want. They're not stupid. They just realize that it's impossible to fight this giant machine. It's very difficult. There's a lot of people who are forming grassroots organizations, and there's even some movement on the local level to even start breaking maybe into this kind of complete corporate control of the political system. So it's not entirely hopeless. The problem is that these meek, relatively reasonable kind of measures would have been wonderful to have, like in the mid-90s. And I always like to, you know, Clinton, history will be unkind to Bill Clinton precisely for presiding over the last great opportunity and doing nothing. Again, you know, maybe not being as awful as George W. Bush, but that's not exactly a very high, you know, standard to keep. He didn't destroy the boom, but he didn't use the surplus to make changes that we kind of all agree that we, you know, we should do.
Wasn't that surplus because of a tech bubble that burst that when he
In some sense, under his supervision, the financial system ate up the tech. And financialized it and turned it into a bubble and popped it. That's kind of a historically... So again, history will not be kind to Bill Clinton, despite him being erected as the kind of the Ronald Reagan of liberals, you know. Of course, we don't have to start on Ronald Reagan.
Please.
Well, it is true, though, you know, because Republicans kind of revere that war criminal idiot Ronald Reagan. And Democrats want one, too. So they have Clinton.
Yeah, right. The one thing I can say for Bill is at least he wasn't a bad actor.
Maybe, but still, so is
so
there
is
a role
the next
to...
generation of politicians coming from?
No.
It can come from on the ground. You know, you look at, as I said, look at the poor countries to the south, like Haiti or Bolivia. They have elected people from the ground, from their own ranks. And in a place like Bolivia, what Evo Morales is doing, he's actually leading the fight against climate change. Right, it's him.
It's the only place anybody's doing anything about the environment is the Socialist Republics in Latin America.
It's the First Nations in Canada. We don't need to rely on very powerful people from Harvard Law School.
It's a non-elitist education that's going on there. I want to kind of summon. That's education too. Maybe that's go back to this kind of idea that we don't have to be in a beautiful campus with facilities and institutions, but perhaps break it up. Could we share? I mean, you know, this is why we spend all this time on this show in a large sense, because we want to take it. I feel a little bit always kind of in a positive, doing a hacking of my own class, you know, when I talk about it with my students who pay ridiculous amounts of money I couldn't afford to go to school, I want to take it out for free on the airwaves because it makes me feel that I'm a little bit more useful. Break those walls up. could be a revolutionary move with no guillotines or pitchforks required.
But here's an informal ed right now. We talked about it a little bit last time. Code School here in Orlando.
Yeah.
Might be a good time to.
Yeah, he's big on that stuff.
To plug our EdTech meetup on December 10th. Benny and I are doing the EdTech meetup on gamification and things.
Yeah. EdTech somewhere.
But the informal ed movement, you know. That's big money. It's also really, aside from the money aspect, we focus so much on money, it is really preparing people to be successful. You know, really a lot in technology and coding and things like that, but it's not just those things. And I think it's an example of that informal education that is resonating with getting a job and being able to you get that job, your micro-credentialing, your badging and things like that. And I think that that is a change, a positive change that's happening organically from the ground up, from the actual users themselves. I also think in terms of ed tech, a lot of the innovative things that are going on right now obviously are not at your big companies, you know, like Blackboard, et cetera. It's bubbling up from smaller, you know, companies that are formed by students themselves, student coders themselves. And you look at some of the innovative things in ed tech, in Detroit right now, it's a sort of a burgeoning tech scene right there. There's a few companies like Ginkgo Tree, for instance, who are creating this interactive open education learning environment where you can load your own materials. And so I see a lot of positive change, you know, coming from the grassroots. Yeah,
right. You know, I do want to mention something about Bolivia and Haiti. The point that we're missing about those countries versus our country is that most of those countries, their culture is more on the communal side versus our culture has been promoting individualism all the way. So for us to be able to even get there, we have to change the way our culture thinks.
And that goes to education too, by the way, because our education, traditional education, is very individualistic and atomized also.
Right.
So in terms
it's not
of,
a good thing.
In terms of that whole, you know, I wanted to talk about that coding thing a little bit because You know, I'm getting into it, and a lot of these small companies. Well, yeah, they're kind of small, but it's still a lot of it is still coming from the top. So, you know, a lot of it, the money that, even though there are student coders who are starting the business, a lot of the money is coming from really big, you know, venture capitalists. You know, it's a lot of fundraising. Also, too, it's somewhat misleading because the programming languages industry or the computer science industry has a vested interest in doing that because it's science, right? So you want to do that. Nobody kind of copyrights science. It's well, except the medical industry, they do, but. But for the most part, things like
that would be high
you know, physics,
yeah, you can't share.
You know, physics, you know, chemistry, biology. It's not necessarily a copyrighted kind of thing. So they have an interest in making that education free. And if you look at, for example, the books and the literature that is coming out, where people can teach themselves how to write code. The books are DRM free.
Code Academy, you can do that on Code Academy.
Right. Yep. And also to the books by every one of the major publishers, whether it's Pragmatic Publishers, O'Reilly, No Starch Press, they have DRM free books, right? Because once again, they have a vested interest of let your friend. Go off and share with your friends that learn JavaScript book or the Eloquent JavaScript book, and they can go off and learn how to code because we need more people for the industry.
Why do they need more people to do it that way? Used to learn how to code?
Yeah, you used to learn it like at school or universities, but yeah.
But, you know, that still doesn't change the corporate attitude when it comes to hiring.
Well, yeah. Also, not only that, too, but the corporate attitude
of
some of the companies as well, you know, like what they're doing in terms of, a lot of the companies who do build things like, say, social networks is to, they might have, the people who do it might have a very nice intention.
but also to the users of these new technologies are using them, and they're selling themselves and their identities as commodities. So,
but can institutions, but again, do they replace? Can institutions become kind of hubs of such a kind of cooperative sharing learning networks? Well, or, because we kind of view it as potentially a competition, right? Where we have, why can't I open a school at home because I'm not accredited?
And well, that doesn't stop you from opening a school at home. It stops you from having an articulation agreement with an accredited school.
Yeah.
So what you're talking about, two different things. You're talking about credentialing and you're talking about education, and they're not always the same.
Sure.
I mean, I can join any sort of club and learn how to do a skill or learn something that I didn't know before without the credentialing. Right.
Mm-hmm. What's the value of the credential?
Right.
That's
being
question.
Able to apply the skill. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're talking about coding and getting the books and things, and we're talking about this, we're right at the cusp of this very innovative way of learning, but we're still stuck to the old modality of doing it. You have a book, but now it's free.
Typically historical.
You know, what if we get rid of the book and we strip out the prime material?
You hit on something when you mentioned what's your paper worth.
What is it? I mean, that's the question.
To be able to change that, I mean, when you have a pool of people with the same education, to be able to change that, you actually have to do law to be able to say, okay, you have a piece of paper, it's worth this much, this is how much you're getting paid. And corporations are not going to like that because they want to be able to hire who they want and pay whatever they want.
But
bottom line, profitability.
I don't agree that that's necessarily true, though, because, I mean,
but it's happening now.
But there's still such a thing as a job interview, right? I mean, you have employees who go in and they meet face-to-face with the hiring manager or director.
Well, almost not anymore. Just about every interview that I've done since I've left Rollins has been online. Or on the phone when it's a real person.
And just the quantity of jobs. So there is that underlying issue that is somewhat separate, quite frankly, but they're not separate. That is a systemic, our system is failing. It's sinking fast. Education can't pull it, I don't think, alone, you know. It's an interesting dynamic in how education system can adjust, to what it adjusts. I mean, could it change?
There's a question here about what are the expectations for the system that we have, and it seems that there is a recurring sense here that we have a failure in terms of our political leadership to create opportunities that we used to have around the operation of institutions, be they educational institutions, corporate institutions, that used to be highly regulated. But the creation of the regulatory state as we used to have started in the 19th century and started with workers and protests that was cross-sectional, right? Mm-hmm. Farmers were protesting, and urban poor were protesting. Yep. The plantation south, even the long-forgotten middle class that go, actual plantations aren't good for anybody. All these people represented a kind of challenge that at some level been systematically removed from our system over the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
Deregulation. If we want to blame Bill Clinton for anything, we should blame him for, like, basically, letting go financial.
And we can blame the biggest deregulator, Ronald Reagan.
Clinton worse even in many ways.
He started busting the unions.
That's a race to the bottom. He's right. What Julian said, I think, is a perfect point. I mean, I think that I love it, in the sense that we have this issue. We've been here before in the 19th century with a dramatically changing economic system, and the education system had to change dramatically too. And it was both forced to change by the changes of the world and was also instrumental in helping usher in nothing's perfect, but a better system behind it.
And one of the I think that our friends have come back to many times is this idea that education at that time, and I think at some level now, I'm not necessarily always convinced at some of these elements that education, I think at the end of the 19th century, went into a phase where there was a commitment to making it as open as possible, right? Like the idea that you could get access to education. Famously, people would go to MIT and were able to listen to lectures and professors would be there giving people, sharing what they knew. Like the idea that you could share what you know.
Okay, well,
we're totally out of time. We're hot. We're finally hot on the solution. So listen, why don't you come back and soon.
Yep.
As soon as possible.
You have been listening to WPRK, Winter Park, Florida, the voice of Honest College, and the best in basement radio. And remember that the opinions stated here today are solely ours and not of those who work here at Rollins College or at the station or anything that's
fitting
with Rollins.
We'll do this again as soon as possible. We need to keep it on. Education is revolution.
Thanks for having us.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The preceding program did not reflect the views or opinions of the station, its management, or employees.